Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
The TRE Book Show is sponsored by Audible. Click on the Audible banner on the talkradioeurope.com homepage to download your free audiobook today. Terms and conditions apply.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening. Welcome to tonight's book show. My first guest is Adrian McKinty, who was born and grew up in Belfast during the Troubles. He went to Oxford University on a full scholarship to study philosophy before emigrating to the US to become a high school English teacher. His novel, The Chain, has recently won Crime Writing's Premier Award, the Theakston Old Peculiar Crime Novel of the Year 2020. He shares his fascinating story of giving up writing altogether and working in a bar and driving an Uber before everything changed. Also with us is Marjorie McInn. She's a Scottish-born author and journalist brought up in Australia. A youthful work and travel year in Athens inspired a lifelong fascination for Greece. In 2010, she, along with her husband and dog, set off for an adventure in the southern Peloponnese. They lasted 4 years, and that was the basis for her travel memoirs, Things Can Only Get Fetter, Homer's Where the Heart Is, and A Scorpion in the Lemon Tree. Her latest novel, How Greek Is Your Love, is the sequel to A Saint for the Summer. Such great titles. Also joining us is Claire Pollard, who's published 4 collections of poetry, including Changeling, which is a Poetry Society recommendation. Her documentary for radio, My Male Muse, was a Radio 4 pick of the year. Fierce Bad Rabbits explores the stories behind our favourite picture books, looking at their histories and what they really mean. You will see the Mr. Men and the Very Hungry Caterpillar in a very different light. And finally, on tonight's book show is Rob Parker, the author of the Ben Bracken thrillers. A member of the Northern Crime Syndicate, he's a regular voice on the Blood Brothers crime podcast. His novel, Far From the Tree, was recently selected as Audible's Crime and Thriller Pick of the Month for July 2020. That's all on tonight's book show on Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the States is Adrian McKinty, who was born and grew up in Belfast, Northern Ireland, during the Troubles of the 70s and 80s. He went to Oxford University to study philosophy before emigrating to the United States to become a high school English teacher. He's a reviewer and critic for the Sunday Morning Herald, the Irish Times and the Guardian. A couple of years ago, he'd given up on writing altogether and was working in a bar and driving an Uber. But just recently, only a few weeks or so ago, he won the Theakston Old Peculiar Crime Novel of the Year 2020 for his recent novel, The Chain. Welcome to the book show, Adrian.
It's lovely to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you with us, and congratulations.
Oh, gosh, thank you so much. Yes, I'm still, as you say, it was about, I suppose, about 10 days ago, but I'm still in a bit of a whirlwind about it. It's great.
Oh, and yeah, as recently as 2 years ago, you were working in a bar and driving an Uber and thought that was it writing wise for you.
Well, yes. I mean, I had been writing this series of crime novels set in Northern Ireland during the 80s, what's called Sean Duffy series. And I'd written 6 of those books. And unfortunately, they had... The first one had come out and hadn't done that well, and then all the other ones had come out and done even less well, and I was a bit of an idiot. It took me 6 books to realize that I wasn't going to make a living at this, so I quit after the 6th book, and then we were kind of living, my family was living in Australia, and I didn't really have the papers to do a lot of stuff, work papers that was, so I ended up getting a job in a bar and driving my car as an Uber.
So what made you start writing again?
Well, like I say, I felt I'd given it a good shot. I mean, if you did one book and then quit, that would be foolish. But I've done six of those. So I felt I'd given it a good run. I tried my best. And I went back to I wasn't going to be in a bar my whole life. I was going to work as a school teacher. And I did a little blog post letting people know that I was taking a break from writing for at least a couple of years to go back and get my teaching certification and, you know, get my life sorted out. And then I got a phone call from Don Winslow, and the American crime writer. And it turned out that not only was he a fan of my books, but that he was reading my blog, which was very surprising because I would have thought that he would have better things to do than read my blog. And Winslow says to me, "Well, Adrian, what's all this going on?" And I said, "Well, you know, just career-wise, I'm in a real slump. And I thought I would take a break for 2 or 3 years to get my life sorted out." And he said, "But I love your books. The problem with you isn't a book problem. It isn't a content problem. It's a marketing problem. Would you mind terribly if I gave your books to my agent, who is also my best mate, this guy called Shane Salerno?" And I said, "Sure, Don, give them to whoever you want." And then, so we had a pleasant enough phone call, and then he hung up, and then I heard nothing more for about 2 or 3 weeks.
And then what happened? I'm on tenterhooks here.
Then it all started to get weird. Very weird. I had had a rather unpleasant day. Just a lot of things hadn't worked out. And it was midnight. As I was coming in the house, my phone rang. And it was this American literary agent called Shane Salerno. And he started giving me his spiel in a very American way. And he immediately just rubbed me the wrong way. And he was talking about how I was a great writer and I was a genius and all this stuff. And I didn't want to hear any of this stuff. And I found him very, very irritating. And it was just the thin end of a wedge or the straw that broke the camel's back. And I basically said, "Yeah, mate, thanks very much for your interest." And I hung up on him. And then about 30 seconds later, he called me right back and he said, "Oh, my God, don't hang up on me, Adrian. You know, you gotta, I'm really here to help you. I'm Don's friend." And so he started talking again and he said, "Google me, Google me." And, you know, I didn't want to Google him. It was now 12:15 at night. And so I didn't Google him. Instead, I said, "Thank you so much for your interest. And I want to thank Don for his interest. But I've made my decision. I'm going on this different track in my life. And good night." And I hung up on him a second time. And then I started walking up the stairs because I was going to say good night to the wife and kids if they were still awake. And then he calls me on the stairs a third time.
Oh, my goodness.
And the Talmud says, if someone tries something three times, you should listen to him. So I thought, okay, I'll listen to this guy. So I sat on the stairs and he said, "Adrian, look, let's cut to the chase. I don't think there's a problem with your writing. I think there's a problem with the geographic setting of books. Is it possible you have an American book in you that we could market and sell in America and then throughout the world?" And that's where he got me a little bit, because I'd been thinking about this American story for about 5 or 6 years. It had been in my head. And I said, "Well, okay, I've got this American idea called The Chain." And he said, "Oh, tell me, what's that about?" And I said, "Well, a woman's driving to a hospital in Boston. She gets this call from a frantic stranger who says, 'I'm really sorry to have to tell you this, Rachel, but I've kidnapped your daughter, Kylie. And the only way you're going to get her back is the way I'm going to get my son back, is if you pay the ransom and kidnap someone else to take her place. And we're now part of this terrible entity known as The Chain.'" And so I pitched that to Shane, who was in his Hollywood Hills house, and he got real quiet and he said, "Yep, Adrian, that's the one." I knew it. Send me that book. And I said, "Oh no, I've misrepresented myself. There's no book. There's just that pitch." And he said, "Well, send me the first chapter. Everything you've got, your notes, your first chapter." And I said, no, mate, there's no first chapter. No notes. There's that one sentence in my head that I've just told you." And then he said to me, "Well, what are you doing right now?" And I said, "Right now, it's 1:45 here in Melbourne, Australia. I'm going to bed." And he said, no, don't do that. Sleep's overrated. Open up your laptop and write me the first chapter and send it to me." So he's a very persuasive man.
Yes.
Bizarrely, sitting at the kitchen table at 1:15 in the morning, typing The Chain by Adrian McKinty, chapter one. And bizarrely, I ended up not writing the first chapter. I ended up writing about the first 30 pages because I got into a flow state. And that's extremely rare for me as a writer. I mean, normally I would write a line, delete a line, write a word, delete it. You know, I have a lot of trouble with actually, you know, getting in a state where everything seems to work. But that night, because I was so angry, I think, I found myself writing the first, I guess, 3 or 4 chapters of The Chain. And then I sent it to him. And I also hoped that that would end the phone calls. And so I sent that to him. And then I finally got upstairs at about 2:45. And my wife was sitting up in bed, and Leah said to me, what was all that shouting about?" And apparently I'd been shouting various points in the conversation. I said, "Oh, this is American agent on the phone." And I forgot to say one thing. I had said to him angrily, "Well, it's all very well for you calling from Hollywood, you know, but I'm in Australia and I've got a job. I have to get up in the morning to work." And he said to me, and it was so irritating the way he said it. He said, "Well, I can see that money is a big issue for you." And I said, "I think you'll find, mate, outside of, you know, Beverly Hills, that money is an issue for most people on planet Earth."
Yes.
And he said, "Okay, well, let's put an end to that right now. Give me your bank details and I'll wire $10,000 into your bank."
No way.
Yes, way. And I said, $10,000? And he said, "Yeah." And he said, "You can take a couple of weeks off, whatever you're doing, and write me this book." And I said, "Yes, I suppose I could."
I was going to say, I hope you were nice to him at that point.
Yes. So I went up and I told Leah about this, and Leah just burst into tears. She said, "Oh, Adrian, you've fallen for the oldest trick in the book. You've given someone our bank details."
Oh no.
"And you've wired them $10,000 and I go, "No, he's wired us $10,000 and she said, "Oh my god, that's what they always say." So we opened up I hadn't thought to do this. We opened up our online bank to see if all our money was gone or what exactly happened. But in fact, what had happened was he had wired in $10,000.
Gosh, how amazing.
Into our bank account. Lee and I are in a panic. I'm explaining all this. And she said, "Who is this guy?" And we start Googling him. And then the phone rings. And now it's like 3:30. And it's Shane. And he just goes, "Oh my god, Adrian, I just read those 30 pages that you sent me. And they're absolutely fantastic. We just need 300 more exactly like it." So I just went, "Okay." And he said, "What time is it there now?" And I said, "Mate, it's 3:30 in the morning." And he just goes, "Oh man, it's so late. You better get some sleep. You have a book to write." And he hung up with me.
Oh, wow. I see what you mean by it being a weird day.
Yeah, it was absolutely bananas. And there's a little sequel. I haven't told this story before. So I went to bed, and normally I would get the kids ready for school. And but Leah said, "Look, Adrian, you're shattered. I'll get the kids ready for school. You just sleep." So she, I woke up about 11, and when I woke up, Leah was gone, and the two girls were gone, and the house was empty. And I literally said to myself, "Oh my God, what a weird dream I just had. That was so bonkers." I was in this phone call. I started writing this book I'd been thinking about for years. And it's just, I literally was convinced it was a dream until I opened up my Hotmail and I found 9 emails from Shane Salerno. I thought, "Oh my God, it really happened."
Wow, what an amazing story. And now you've won a big award as well, the Theaksonal Peculiar Crime Novel of the Year for The Chain.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it's so bizarre. It literally is a weird fairy tale. I mean, it so is a fairy tale. Like, to go from to being so annoyed and pissy during the concept, having this book dragged out of me, literally, and then for just everything to go right, like the reviews, the sales, and now this. It's really incredible.
Fantastic. So tell us about, so you told us a bit about the story and the premise of The Chain. Can you tell us about some of the characters?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the whole thing, it was so weird because I had the whole thing in my head. I just didn't want to write it. It wasn't really my cup of tea. It's not something I'd ever done before. I'd never done a thriller before. But everything, like, I didn't have to sit and struggle for days trying to figure out who the protagonist is or anything like that. I just knew everybody. My protagonist was Rachel, and she was a single mom in her 30s. She lived in Boston. She was a part-time teacher. And she was getting her life back together after a divorce and cancer. And I kept thinking to myself, okay, so here's this poor woman. You feel really bad for her. And then this terrible thing happens. Her lovely 13-year-old daughter, smart, you know, quick 13-year-old daughter, the light of her life, is kidnapped. And then this ordinary person has to somehow deal with that situation. And then, horror of horrors, this very moral, decent human has to go and try and figure out how to kidnap someone else's child to get her child back. And I thought, well, that's going to be quite interesting because it's sort of a contrast to two of the things that were in my head were the movie Taken and the movie Ransom. And I wanted this book to be the opposite of both of those. Because in Taken, Liam Neeson is incredibly capable and knows exactly what to do in every situation. And you're confident that he is smart and tough and will do the right thing and he'll succeed in the end. And similarly with Ransom, Mel Gibson is like a billionaire and he has all these resources and, you know, confident and capable. And I thought, well, what if that situation happened to just someone who was ordinary and working class and had no money and no resources and no set of special skills. And so that's what I thought would make the first half of the book so interesting.
Oh, it's a really interesting idea. So is there even more pressure on you now to to deliver another good book after The Chain?
Yeah, well, now it's a nightmare. There's a... there's the famous Undertones. So I don't know if you know the Derry band, the Undertones, but there's a famous song by them called More Songs About Chocolate and Girls. And there's this line in it written by John Bradley. And he says, "It's not so easy writing songs knowing that now they'll be heard." And because previously the Undertones were just singing songs about chocolate and girls, but no one was buying their records. So they could just write about whatever they wanted and it was fine. There was no pressure. But then big hit with Teenage Kicks. And so then it became a nightmare for them because their lyrics were analyzed and scrutinized in the NME and Melody Maker and places like that. And they had to really make sure every single after Teenage Kicks was really, really good. And I find myself in that horrific situation where I know that my next book is going to have to be good because people are going to read it and they're going to analyze it. So, yes, it's the first time ever I felt any pressure.
Yeah.
Because previously, basically what would happen before is I would write a book, it would get one or two good reviews, and then it would vanish forever. My old books were barely edited and copy edited. I could literally just write anything I wanted. But now I know that, oh my God, literally tens of thousands of people are probably going to read the next one. So I better have something to say, and it better be about something. And otherwise I'll be in big trouble.
No pressure. Well, if people want to read The Chain, it's a really great story. It's by Adrian McKinty, the award-winning Adrian McKinty, who we've been chatting to. They can get it on our website in the TRE bookshop section on tre.radio. Adrian, thank you so much for joining us. It's been great to chat with you.
It's been brilliant to chat to you, and thank you so much for having me.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Marjorie McGinn. She's a Scottish-born author and journalist brought up in Australia. She worked in Scotland for 10 years as a freelance feature writer, and her journalism has appeared in newspapers in Britain and Australia. A youthful work travel year in Athens inspired a lifelong fascination for Greece. And in 2010, she set off on an adventure with her husband and their dog to the southern Peloponnese that lasted for 4 years and was the basis for her travel memoirs, Things Can Only Get Fetter, Homer's Where the Heart Is, and A Scorpion in the Lemon Tree. She's with us on the book show to talk about her latest novel. It's called How Greek Is Your Love, and it's a sequel to A Saint for the Summer. Welcome to the book show, Marjorie.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
It's a real pleasure to have you with us. And I love the titles of your books. I think they're fabulous. They make me sing.
<Thank you. laughs> Well, the memoirs, there was a touch of madness in the memoirs because of the times that we had in Greece. So I felt that the titles needed to reflect that.
Yes, definitely. So you went for an adventure and stayed for 4 years. That sounds like a great adventure to me.
Yes, it was. It was. We went in 2010, basically because we wanted to have an adventure in Greece, but there was a recession at the time in Britain, a terrible winter. We were living in Scotland, and a downturn in the newspaper industry, so we thought, let's just pack up and go. But what we wanted was a very Greek experience, so we ended up in a hillside village. We took our dog Wallace, who's a Jack Russell, and I don't know if you know them, but they're very fizzy and mad, so that kind of guaranteed we'd have a bit of a giggle anyway. So we stayed in that village for a year, and then we moved to a village nearby, and that really inspired the books.
And whereabouts in Greece were you?
Well, we're in the southern Peloponnese, which not a lot of people are really familiar with, but it's the jaggy bit at the bottom, you know, the three peninsulas, the jaggy bit, and we were in the middle one, which is called the Marni. So it was quite wild. We picked it because it was quite wild and off the beaten track, because we wanted a very different kind of experience, you know, where we didn't, much as we love British expats, we didn't particularly want to have that experience. We wanted to meet Greeks, and I had some Greek, enough to get by, from lots of previous trips to Greece, so we set about just making a lot of Greek friends and doing Greek things, really, you know, olive harvests and going to all sorts of festivals and things like that. So it was an authentic kind of experience.
Yeah.
With a lot of madness in it too. And I have to say, a lot of that inspired by Wallace, the dog, because people had never seen a Jack Russell before in this particular village, which is quite a traditional village. And one village woman thought, the first day she saw us, that we were taking a sheep out for a walk, a small goat, because he has, you know, he had a black face and white body. So that was a conversation opener, but people were bemused by Wallace's behaviour. And in a funny way, he led us into many friendships with Greek people, I think.
And what was it like being in Greece in such a small village that, as you say, is very traditional? Because I think a lot of people sort of fantasize about doing that, moving to Greece or Spain or Italy and living in a very authentic village. But often it's not as idyllic as people imagine. How did you find it?
Well, because I had been to Greece quite a lot, more than my husband Jim, but I was quite prepared to go beyond my comfort zone. You know, I knew that I would have to do that if it was going to be an interesting experience. So I probably pushed the boat out a bit further than some people might have. And we didn't pick, you know, the idyllic village by the sea with bougainvillea on the houses and all that. That's beautiful, but we didn't pick that sort of surroundings. This was a working village where people had for centuries been growing olives, herding goats and sheep and all that sort of thing. So it had some quite rough edges. It wasn't the archetypical. I suppose in many ways a little bit like Corfu was when the Darrells first went there, if you've seen that.
Yes, yes.
On TV, it was a little bit rough around the edges. The houses we rented were, you know, a bit rough around the edges sometimes. And because the people were starting to feel the effects of the crisis, which they were, things were probably a bit more tense than they would have otherwise been. So we had the whole thing, you know, the whole experience of kind of living through all that with them. And let's be fair, we weren't affected by the crisis the way they were, because we were freelancing, writing articles for various publications, so we didn't rely on, you know, Greek incomes the way they did. So we were kind of outsiders still looking in. You can never really get into the heart of a village unless you've been there a long, long time and you speak fluent Greek. So in a sense, we were always outsiders, but we did see a lot of what was going on at the time. I mean, and it was fascinating, it was.
And did the locals embrace you?
Yes, they did. They did, because we were up for it. You know, we did go beyond our comfort zone. You know, we did a lot of things that were sometimes uncomfortable, and we made, yes, they did, particularly, and oddly, one of the women that I in particular became most friendly with was a woman called Eleni, who's in the books, but I changed her name, but Eleni is her real name, and she was just a goat herder from a mountain village, and she became, in an odd kind of way, a muse, you know, like a literary muse. I think once I met her, and she had us coming to her farm for coffee quite a lot, which was quite a challenging space, as Greek farms always are. She had us there for coffee quite a lot, and I got to know her quite well. And she quite inspired me, to be honest, to write the first book. I thought, well, this is a gift. You know, I've met this woman. She's like nobody I'm ever going to meet in my life again. And I'm going to work her into a book.
Fabulous.
So I did. So, yes, they did embrace us. We made a lot of friends. And although we're obviously not there anymore, we had to come back. I still keep in touch with quite a lot of them. You know, I write to them.
Yeah. In Greek?
I can write in Greek. It takes me an awful long time, yes.
Wow, that's impressive, though.
Well, it's tough. I write short little notes to them in Greek. It takes me quite a while because none of them, that's the thing, none of these Greeks, the Greek villagers, the farmers, none of them spoke English. So that's a bonus. My advice to anybody who wants to go to Greece to have an adventure is pick a village where nobody speaks English.
A real challenge.
Maybe one, just to help you out the whole sometimes. But, and then you really, you know, things will take off.
Mm. So with your books, A Saint for the Summer and now the sequel, How Gweak Is Your Love, what was the difference for you writing fiction compared to non-fiction?
Well, I had always wanted to write fiction, and I have got a novel in one of my bottom drawers that I wrote years ago, which I didn't think was good enough. So fiction was always in my mind, but the three memoirs were a reflection of our time in Greece, you know, what the things that we went through, the adventures and all of that. But then, of course, we came back. We had to come back to Britain for personal reasons, all kinds of reasons. And we're now back here for good, as far as, you know, for good ever means. But So I couldn't give up writing. I wanted to write more, so I decided I had had so many experiences in Greece while we'd been there that I could turn that into fiction. I had lots of ideas for fiction, so I just started writing. I wrote the first one. I thought, oh, that'll be it. And then I wrote the second one. The second one is really a sequel to the first one, but they can be read as standalones. I have written them that way in case people just want to read one. So they're both set in the same area, in the Mani. And a lot of the characters are very similar to some of the real characters we met. So in a sense, it was like a natural progression, if you like, from the memoirs.
Mm. And the books feature expat journalist Bronte McKnight. Any reflection on you?
Well, yes, there is a lot of me in Bronte. She's Scottish. She was a journalist in Scotland. There is a lot of me in her, yes. But, you know, they say that you should write what you know.
Yeah.
And because I had spent many years as a journalist, I thought, well, she'll have to be a journalist. That's all there is to it. So just briefly, but she goes to Greece to help her expat father, Angus, who's a bit maverick, with a health problem. But it turns out that it's a family mystery that he wants Bronte to help him solve that goes back to the Second World War. Probably don't have time to hear what that's all about. Suffice to say that it's to do with a grandfather who was there during the war, who went missing. And they do solve the mystery, and then she falls in love with a gorgeous Greek doctor and stays on in Greece. And that's where the second novel really picks up, you know, what's happened to her now in Greece. She's in love with this guy. Is Greece everything she thought it was going to be? And not always necessarily. So that's how the two books at least are linked.
Fantastic. Well, it sounds like a great story. It's called How Gweak Is Your Love, and it's by Marjorie McKinn, who we've been chatting to. Listeners can get a copy of the book on our website, tre.radio, in the bookshop section there. Marjorie, thank you so much for joining us. It's been lovely to talk Greece with you.
Thank you very much. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. Thank you for inviting me.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
TRE.
The TRE Book Show is sponsored by Audible. Click on the Audible banner on the talkradioeurope.com homepage to download your free audiobook today. Terms and conditions apply.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now is Claire Pollard. She's published four collections of poetry, including Changeling, which was a Poetry Book Society recommendation. Her documentary for radio, My Male Muse, was a Radio 4 Pick of the Year. She's with us on the book show to talk about one of her most recent books called Fierce Bad Rabbits, The Tales Behind Children's Picture Books. Welcome to the book show, Claire.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you with us. Thanks for joining us. I'm interested, first of all, just asking you about poetry in general, because it means so many different things to different people, and people have different views on it. What does it mean to you?
Oh, wow. You've hit me with a big question there to start with. I suppose for me, it's that kind of Coleridge idea of the best words in the best order. It's language where you're working at the level of the line, the level of the word, perhaps even the level of the letter, you know, the sound of the letter. So it's kind of writing where every word has to be absolutely perfect and imbued with as much kind of meaning, and that can be sonic meaning as well as the actual meaning of the word, as possible, really.
Yes.
So writing where every word counts.
Yes. And how about rhyming poetry? Because some people, when they think of poetry, it's always something that rhymes, but of course many, many great poems don't.
Yeah, well, I'm actually a big fan of rhyme, and I rhyme quite often in my own poetry. But what people have to understand is poetry hasn't always rhymed. I mean, Shakespeare's poetry, and it doesn't rhyme. Milton, Paradise Lost, doesn't rhyme. And a lot of historic poetries don't rhyme. So there's nothing actually traditional about rhyme. It was a kind of romantic and Victorian trend, really.
Yeah.
But it's something I like, and I certainly like it in children's poetry, which kind of leads into my book, Fierce Bad Rabbits, The Tales Behind Children's Picture Book, because one of the things that I suppose made me think I was allowed to write about these books, I hadn't previously been an expert in children's literature, is that I'm a poetry critic, and so many children's books, especially picture books, are written in rhyme.
Yes, I think that's a great way of getting children not just into poetry, but into stories and reading in general, isn't it? Having rhyming stories.
Absolutely, and it helps them kind of remember the stories. It leads to that lovely moment of interaction, doesn't it, where you kind of say the first rhyming line and then wait for them to kind of complete it.
Mm.
Harry McClary from Donaldson's, and you wait, and then your little girl says, oh, dairy, remembers the rhyme, you know.
Yes. So what was your kind of thought process behind this book then, Fierce Bad Rabbits? Why did you decide to write it?
It came from two things, really. One is I always write about my life. My poetry's always been quite confessional. I'd already written a book of poetry about the experience of kind of childbirth and having a small child. But what I thought I wanted to write about next was really that preschool period. It's actually a funny day to be speaking to you, because it's my daughter's last day at nursery today.
Oh.
And next week she'll be starting school.
How exciting.
So it's kind of the end of an era.
Yes.
But I think there is this kind of magical time. I've been very steeped in this preschool world for the last 7 years of my two children, and it's this kind of world of rhyme time, singing wheels on the bus, soft play, blowing bubbles, paddling pools, Peppa Pig, rice cakes. It's got its own culture, you know, and it's this fleeting time, but this time in which I think our whole personalities are shaped in a way. And I wanted to write a book in a way to capture this special time, I suppose. It's a kind of love song to that preschool age.
Mm.
On the other hand, I'm also a kind of literary critic. That's what I do. And I was spending so much time reading these picture books. And, you know, you read them like you read no other book in your life. You read them over and over and over again. And often they're books that were read to you hundreds of times when you were a child as well. You know these books kind of in your heart and soul in a way, you know, you'll never know another book or an adult book. And just reading these books so many times, I started to kind of analyze them, to use that part of my brain, that literary critic part of my brain, and start to think, hey, what are these stories about, and what are these things I'm repeating thousands of times, what are they teaching my children? But also just to recognize the genius, I suppose, of these writers. You realize how amazingly talented someone like Shirley Hughes is, for example. You know, she's one of our great living geniuses, and I don't think we kind of celebrate her enough.
So one of the things that you found was that some of these picture books have a real kind of darker side to them that maybe you wouldn't notice just reading through without your analytical mind.
Well, I don't know. I mean, a lot of the great classics have a darkness that probably parents do notice. A kind of famous example is The Tiger That Came to Tea. Most parents have their theories about that one. It kind of, you can't help speculating, can you, what the tiger represents, whether the mother's having an affair, whether she's kind of an alcoholic and she'd even call them daddy's beer, you know, whether it's about her depression. There's all these kind of theories about it. Michael Rosen's said to have said that it always made him think of the Gestapo because, Judith Kerr kind of escaped Germany as a little girl. Her father's books were burnt and they had to escape as a family. And for him, it always kind of represented that threat that you never knew who might knock on your door when she was a little girl.
Yes. What about basic books? I mean, obviously from a very young age, and I remember having this book read to me hundreds of times as a child, The Very Hungry Caterpillar. Were you able to find a hidden meaning in that one?
Yes, oh yes. I can find a hidden meaning in all of them. That's been described as being about capitalism, basically.
Oh, wow. Okay, yeah.
It was banned in parts of Eastern Europe, I think.
Really?
There was this idea. Actually, I'm not sure it was banned. I need to check my facts there before I say that. But it was frowned on in parts of Eastern Europe for this idea that, you know, the caterpillar just kind of has all this food and just takes a bite of everything and doesn't care and wastes it all and gets big and fat, and it was and then turns into something beautiful. You know, it's almost a hymn to consumption and greed.
Yes, how fascinating. So did you find out things through kind of researching for the books? Did you find hidden meanings that you really weren't aware of and were kind of surprised to see?
I think Owl Babies is a really interesting one. Martin Waddell, the writer of that, was in County Down, and he went into a church, saw what he thought was a wasp's nest, and it exploded. It was a bomb. And for 6 years after that, he couldn't work and looked after his sons at home. And that book, for those of you who don't know it, Owl Babies, is about these three little owls waiting for their mummy to come home. And it's quite frightening, and it just focuses on them in this dark wood. And then at the end, it's very comforting. She comes back and she said, "What's all the fuss? You know, you knew I'd come back." But actually, when you realise the kind of story behind it, you think, well, they didn't know she'd come back. You know, it's a dangerous world out there. Something could have happened to her, as it happened to Martin Waddell, you know. I think having known the backstory, there is a real darkness in the back of that story to me.
Mm, interesting. And what about all the Mr. Men books?
Yeah, well, I mean, I love the drawings in the Mr. Men books.
Yeah,
they're so kind of iconic, and but the stories are, well, the stories are very ethically odd and difficult once you start unpicking them. I mean, of course, Roger Hargreaves was writing at a time when people were still smacking and stuff, and that was still legal. But there's a real thread of physical violence running through it. You know, Mr. Nosey's punished for his nosiness. You know, we might ask what's so bad about being curious anyway. But he's punished for his nosiness by being hammered by all the villagers.
Oh, gosh.
With a literal hammer, you know. So, but then, you know, there's this kind of greediness is punished. But then other things aren't. You know, Mr. Tall leaves Mr. Small at the beach, and that's hilarious. So kindness isn't necessarily one of the moral qualities that Roger Hargreaves celebrates.
Mm.
I think it's also worth looking at the Little Miss books. You'd think it's about 1981 he starts the Little Miss books, and you'd think he'd be doing it as a kind of feminist thing. Oh, you know, hang on, we should be having some, representing some girls here.
Yeah.
The first Little Miss book is actually Little Miss Bossy, and she's a kind of middle-aged spinster she's depicted as. And at the end, all the Mr. Men kind of combine forces to punish her and humiliate her.
God.
So it's really not a feminist book at all for the first Little Miss, and I think kind of sets the tone. After that, we get Miss Scatterbrain, Miss Dotty, Miss Chatterbox, Miss Plump, unbelievably.
No way!
Changed to Little Miss Greedy later on.
Gosh, I didn't realise there was a Miss Plump. That's awful.
Yeah,
That's terrible. Oh, dear. Well, it's a really, really interesting subject. I'm looking forward to delving more into it. The book is called Fierce Bad Rabbits, The Tales Behind Children's Picture Books, and it's by Claire Pollard, who we've been chatting to today. Claire, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Rob Parker. He's the author of the Ben Bracken thrillers. He's a member of the Northern Crime Syndicate and a co-host of the For Your Reconsideration film podcast. Rob is also a regular voice on the Blood Brothers crime podcast. He's with us on the Book Show to talk about his latest novel, Far From the Tree. It's the first in an exclusive Audible original crime trilogy. It's been narrated by BAFTA-winning Warren Brown, and it was selected as Audible's Crime and Thriller Pick of the Month for July. Welcome to the Book Show, Rob.
Hello there. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks for joining us. And congratulations, selected as the Pick of the Month.
Oh, it's been a whirlwind, but it's been the best whirlwind of all time. It's one of those pinch me moments, really. I've loved every moment of this. I've been published. This is my seventh book. So there's no sort of overnight smash hit sensation here. So it's taken a long time to get here. But my word, am I enjoying it now I've got here.
Oh, wonderful. And what's the difference writing for Audible, writing for an audio book instead of writing a normal published book?
Well, it's really interesting because I never sort of wrote it for that purpose. I just wrote it as, you know, sometimes you've got an itch you need to scratch. And I really needed to get this story written. I just had something that I wanted to do and say. And I also felt like I'd matured enough as a man and as a writer to be able to attempt something totally different from my usual stuff. So I sat down to write this thing just as I would write any of my other books. And it was only afterwards, when it was doing the rounds with publishers, that it was Audible said, well, we actually really like the flavour of this in a dialogue sense, and we think it could work really well for the spoken word and for a listening audience. So that's, yeah, it was their idea, not mine.
How interesting. So you didn't do anything different, supposedly.
Nothing. Not a thing. But I've always enjoyed constructing dialogue and trying out dialogue. One of the things I wanted to do when I was younger was be a screenwriter. So I was always writing scripts, and I felt like that was like dialogue training in a way. So and when it came to Warren Brown reading this dialogue, it was amazing. You know, hearing an actor of his caliber going through and paying the time and care to the characters that you've created and the words you put down, oh, it was just so special.
Oh, must have been. So how does this compare to your previous books? It's very different, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I think, like I say, I think I was trying to grow up a bit here. I mean, not grow up because there's anything especially immature in my early work, but I started writing in 2012, 2013, and, you know, I was sort of in my late 20s then. I'm now sort of getting into my late 30s now, and you change a lot in that period. And I felt like I've experienced fatherhood a few times in that period, and it means everything to me. So, I've developed as a person, and I feel like it's coming across in my writing. And I felt like I had this idea, and I'd sat on this for a good while, maybe 3 or 4 years before I put pen to paper on it, because I didn't feel like I was ready. And I have this great deal with the Ben Bracken books, where my publishers, Loom Books, are just very happy for me to do another one every year. And it's brilliant. As an author, to have that faith is fabulous, because, you know, they've got that trust in me and I've got that trust in them. We know that I'm going to be published at least once a year. And when it came to this, it was just, right, what can we do now? How can I take my career to the next level, my books to the next level? And I wanted to go bigger, bolder, darker, more foreboding. And I really wanted to swing for the fences with this.
Yeah, how exciting. So before we talk more about Far From the Tree, just tell us a bit about the Ben Bracken thrillers. Can you say one comes out every year?
Yeah, one comes out every year. So we've had four out now, and The Watchman is due at the end of this year, which will be the fifth.
Wonderful. And who is Ben Bracken?
Well, Ben Bracken is an ex-soldier that came home from Afghanistan in disgrace. And like a lot of young men who went out there, and women, a sense of duty can sort of hang over you after, you know, I always find it very fascinating, that question of, right, thank you very much for your service, come home, and now go off and get a normal job. And I always found that amazing. And I had three school friends who went away to Iraq and Afghanistan myself, and they came back as very different people and found it very, very, in each in their own way, very difficult to reintegrate themselves back into just the normal 9-to-5 routine. I just didn't know how they do it. I admire them hugely. Mm. And from there, I thought, well, what if you came home and your sense of duty just really wasn't extinguished in any way, and how could you, you know, what scrapes could you get into? So I've had, I mean, I must admit, I've had loads and loads of fun. My friends think that the character of Ben Bracken is me if you took my inhibitions completely away from me, which I assure you is not the case. But I have had loads and loads of fun. And yeah, I do enjoy putting pen to paper on a new one of those every year.
Yeah, it must be difficult because you've been with the character for so long. It must be difficult to imagine letting him go and not writing about him anymore.
It is, but at the same time, you know, I'm obviously very realistic and pragmatic, and if people stop reading them, I would just be like, right, he's done now, we'll go and move on to something else. Because, you know, I'm 37 now, so I realise that I feel like I'm in a really lucky position that I'm writing books for a living at the moment, but it might all go away any minute. So I've got to keep on top of everything, got to keep on the crest of whatever wave I find myself a part of. So if it means I have to change direction, I have to change direction. But at the moment, people still, you know, are still mercifully enjoying what this guy gets up to.
Yeah. So looking at Far From the Tree, what can you tell us about the characters in this book?
Oh, well, again, this was, I think, big themes to me are parenting, fatherhood, the roots that you can't do anything about. And Far From the Tree is obviously, it's a little takeaway from the proverb of where the apple doesn't fall very far from. So the book is really about a mass grave is found in a desolate patch of woodland in Warrington, which is a town that resides directly between Manchester and Liverpool in the north of England. And it has somewhat of an identity crisis because of that, because I live in Warrington and we're half Mancunian and half Liverpudlian, and out of that we've sort of combined and fused our own identity out of that. But I've got a detective inspector, Brendan Foley, is in charge of the investigation to find out not just what happened to these people, but who they are as well. And his journey to the truth brings him much closer to home than he ever thought possible. So again, with this one, great big themes that I really enjoy looking at, and I've had a lot of fun. And one of the great things with this one is it was always penned as a trilogy. So rather than thinking of these themes and an arc that you've got to get done in, you know, a standard novel length, I can look at it over three times that length and really tell a full, complete story.
Fantastic. So there's two more audiobooks to come.
That's right, yeah. And they'll be in print as well. Apart From the Tree is out in print next summer.
Wonderful. And can you see when you've got a book, obviously it started in written form and now you're able to listen to it. Have you visualised it as well? Can you see it being on the TV or the big screen?
Very much so. And especially that, what's made that very, very easier, much easier, is the quality of what Warren Brown has done with this. He rang me the day before he started recording this, because I'll be completely honest, he was always the guy that I wanted to do this audiobook, always, because he's from this neck of the woods and he gets that identity issue I was talking about. And he's gone on to do such fantastic things and worked, you know, and carved out such an amazing place in the industry for himself, that I always wanted it to be him. And as it happens, we train in the same boxing gym up north when he's back. So I knew him, not knew him, I'd seen him knocking about, and he was always the guy who wanted to do it. And he rang me up and he wanted to go through all the characters in very fine detail, because obviously he's providing voices for every single one of them. And I think there's somewhere around 40 characters in the book.
Wow.
So it was like a one-man show listening to this back. And he just did such an amazing job, and he brought life to every single one, every single different character. You can definitely see all those differences and feel totally immersed. And, you know, mercifully, the reviews for the book, for the audiobook have been really good. And I think put so much of that down to what he's done.
Oh, it must be lovely for you to have visualised him being the one to do it, and then that's exactly what happened.
It was, yeah. I mean, 3 years ago I saw him in the boxing gym and I said to him, my agent's going to get in touch with you soon about a project, and I just wanted you to have a name to a face so you knew it came from me. And he must have thought I was absolutely mad. He must get it all the time, you know, people tapping him on the shoulder saying, will you be in my this or that? And then, it was a good 2 years later when he eventually got the tap on the shoulder and said, would you be in this? So it just couldn't have gone any better as far as I'm concerned.
Wonderful. Well, if people want to get a copy or listen to Far From the Tree, as we said, it's coming out in book form next year, but at the moment on Audible, so people can download it, can't they?
That's right, yeah, it's on the Audible online store.
Fantastic. Rob Parker, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this programme, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.